tonight on Arena. Who is and who is not on the Booker Prize shortlist? And Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho turns 60. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start with the much anticipated shortlist for the 2020 Booker Prize, which was revealed today. As ever, there's as much talk about who didn't make the cut as who did. RTE's arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley joins me on the line now. I suppose the big headline is Hilary Mantel is not on the shortlist for The Mirror and the Light, Sinead.
Yeah, let's just draw a veil over the fact that I said on Morning Ireland this morning that she would definitely be on the shortlist, and let's hope that nobody put any money on her being on the shortlist based on that. No, she isn't. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing given what the rest of the shortlist is, but it is a bit of a shock. And I mean, it is a trilogy. The Thomas Cromwell books are a trilogy. They're very much in the same style. So you have to wonder how you have a prize that would let two books in a trilogy win, but not even consider the third for inclusion on the shortlist. So it was a very strong list this year, but yeah, it is a little bit interesting, shall we say, that she didn't make it. Yeah. She'll survive. I think she'll be fine.
And you wouldn't have been the only person who might have said with absolute certainty in recent times that Hilary Mantel will definitely be there, so I don't think you're alone on that one.
Speaking of which, by the way, in terms of terrible predictions, before we get to other people who are on it, the fact that Maggie O'Farrell wasn't even on the long list with Hamnet absolutely baffled me this year as well.
Yeah,
thankfully, it did win the Woman's Prize, but I would advise anyone out there to win that, particularly the times we're in. This is a story that, you know, theatres are being closed because of a plague. Like, it's an astounding book, beautifully written and also really relevant. So I was surprised not to see that on any of the lists, but there you go.
OK, let's stop saying who's not on it for a little while and say who's on it, because the very notable point here is diversity. And diversity and debuts, they're the two big headline words in terms of this year's list.
Absolutely. And very interesting following on from last year, because last year, obviously, you had the two winners, Bernardine Evaristo and Margaret Atwood. Now, I would argue that probably should have gone to Evaristo on her own. And I love Margaret Atwood and I love her work and I loved the book. But in that particular case, I think it was a surprise not to give it to Evaristo. So then what you have this year is a really diverse list with voices from Zimbabwe, India, Ethiopia, working class Glasgow in the 1980s. And then you've got a dystopian environmental style thriller as well. And also a black gay take on the campus novel. So really, I suppose the list couldn't move on any further from the days where it was considered just to be about, you know, white men eating in their London living rooms. It's a very different list these days.
Although, again, much has been made of the fact that I think The Guardian were commenting today that five of the six on the shortlist are either from the US or have hold joint US citizenship. Now, I'm wondering if they're including Douglas Stewart and Shuggy Bain, a very Glaswegian, a very Scottish book. I'm wondering if they're including him in dual citizenship. I'm not sure. I was trying to work out exactly where they were getting their five out of six.
No, I think they're making him the UK entry, shall we say, and the others are, I think, for example, Maza Mengistu, has the Ethiopian novel. I think she has dual.
Yes, she's Ethiopian-American.
Yes, exactly. So I think Douglas Stewart has been considered, I suppose, the UK entrant for, as you say, an incredibly British book and rooted in a very difficult time in Britain and in that, you know, Glasgow in the 80s, and also something coming from a very difficult life. And I know he was on your programme before talking about his own background. So that is a very UK-based book, but the others take you all over the world.
Yeah, and well, let's talk about that Ethiopian-American book, The Shadow King. And it deals with a very specific time in Ethiopian history, I think, around Italy's involvement in Ethiopia.
That's right. And at time, I have to admit, I didn't know much about the link even between the two countries. But it is about an orphan girl living in Ethiopia in 1935. And obviously, world events are, you know, taking place around that. And she disguises herself as a peasant while she turns out she has to fight her own war. So it's got everything from history to, you know, women taking on, I suppose, somewhat controversial roles. And it's certainly a look at, as I say, part of of history that I wouldn't have been familiar with, and very interesting that the Booker is taking us there. I mean, often with other book lists, like for example the Dublin Literary Award, you get this kind of view of other countries and other cultures, but certainly the Booker is offering it to you this year.
Four debuts, is that important?
I think it's interesting, particularly because, you know, if you look at the book trade in general, lots of times there are wonderful debuts that get fantastic reviews and that career mightn't always be sustained, you know. So I think it is interesting to give it to those debuts. At the same time, the book has to stand on its own. So if they felt that they were, you know, that they should have been included, then they should have been. But yeah, it is interesting, and it shows that it's definitely not an award being given, you know, to a body of work or for somebody's reputation. It clearly is standing and falling on those books alone.
I think there's a lot of people, I was certainly disappointed not to see Colin McCann on there for A Peregon as well. Are you prepared to make a prediction at this point, Sinead, in terms of what you know of the six shortlisted books?
If a lot of talk about the Zimbabwean novel Tsitsi Dangaremba. She has written a book called This Mournable Body, which again actually is the third in a trilogy. And it looks at a woman living in Harare and, you know, the difficulties of life in Zimbabwe. But she herself is in the news. She's a filmmaker and playwright, recently arrested, and actually she's due to be in court on the 18th of September. So very much in the news at the moment. So obviously hugely interesting that her novel is being brought to light at the moment while she herself is in the news. So, you know, yes, lots of people. A lot of respect as well for Avani Doshi, the Burnt Sugar novel, which is an Indian book, but it's about a mother, a very nuanced mother-daughter relationship. So, but no, absolutely, I'm not putting any money on it now at this stage.
Well, you don't have to.
The poor Hillary is gone.
We'll talk to you on the closer to November the 17th, which is when the final announcement will be made. We look for a prediction from you at that point, perhaps. That's Sinead Crowley there speaking to us about the six shortlisted books for this year's Booker Prize: The New Wilderness by Diane Cook, The Mournable Body from Tsangi Jerembe, Born Sugar from Avani Doshi, The Shadow King by Mazen Mengistu, Shuggie Bain from Douglas Stewart. We'll put a link up to our interview with him on that one, and Real Life by Brandon Taylor, completing the list. Now, what time is it? 7:10.
Oh, if you've got a wing, oh, take her up to Ringo, where the waxy sing, oh, all the day. If you had your fill of porter and you can't go any further, give your man the order, back to the quay. And take her up to Monto, Monto, Monto. Take her up to Monto, Langaroo, to you.
Ah, yeah, even a verse of it is enough to get you banging your head. Take her up to Monto, the song that the Dubliners, inspired, of course, by Dublin's legendary red light district of Monto. And Monto is at the centre of an event taking place as part of Dublin's Music Town Festival. The festival began last Wednesday, continues through until September the 26th. This Saturday, however, September the 19th, you have the opportunity to be taken on a virtual walking tour through the inner city area of Dublin. And on the tour, Dublin City folklorist Terry Fagan will be joined by folk singer and curator McDara Yates to explore the history of the area and some of the songs that inspired and inspired it. Terry Fagan is with me in studio this evening. McDara Yates is joining us on the line. That song, that really is the heart of Monto, isn't it? It's the one that everybody thinks of, Terry.
Shows her off, really. Like, I mean, you know, it was written by an Irish Times journalist and the Dubliners picked up on it. But Monto is a very fascinating history, you know, and it's not a big area.
We're talking essentially in and around the north inner city. What are the outer bounds?
The boundaries
are
Lower Talbot Street, Lower Buckingham Street, Lower Shamacdermot Street and Lower Garner Street, just in that kind of segment there.
Yeah.
And in amongst that then was, like, I mean, it would have been streets like in those days, Mabbott Street, which we would be renamed in 1906 to Corporation Street, and then in the 1990s to James Shy Street. But in the centre of all that, like, is where the madam set up the prostitution in that area. Like, basically what happens was when the gentry started to move out, the poor moved in, and women were annoyed to make a money, bought property in that area, and they became known as the Monto's first madams, Mrs. Mac, Bella Cohn and Meg Arnott.
And there's no romance about any of this, Monto's
first madams?
There's
no romance whatsoever, no. Like, I mean, what was done to those women was absolutely appalling. Mm. Like, you know, but in that area, it was only decent, hard-working people in it, but trapped in, they couldn't go anywhere. They had the rarest of the families there. But these madams were ruthless.
Yeah. I would just go to McDara, if I can, at this point, Terry, because Terry's touching on it there, I think, McDara, you know, that there's a darkness to this area as well as the nostalgia that inevitably we will get with some songs. And the Dubliner song kind of knocks a bit of fun out of it until you look closely at the lyrics. Is that what's involved here? Looking a bit more closely, in fact, at the songs and finding out a little bit more about the dark side of the story.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, what you heard at the opening of the show there was the George Hodnett song, which, yeah, I guess pokes a bit of fun out of it. It's written by a man who wasn't from the Monto, a man who probably didn't walk the streets very much. There are, in fact, a ton of songs stretching far beyond this one. Songs collected from young kids on the streets, songs written by writers who lived within the area or around the area, Dominic Bean, Pat O'Carney and the like. And yeah, ultimately, it stretched much farther than that song. Great song, though, it is.
Let's listen to another song, Wash Your Lobby. Who's the Dominic Behan that we're talking about here?
Dominic Behan is the younger brother of Brendan Behan, the writer. In my view, there was many writers in the family, but the forgotten brother and the undersung brother. On their home later in Kimmage, it just says, here lived Brendan Behan, and this man made an indelible mark on the Irish song tradition.
All right, so the song that we're about to hear there here is now is a little bit of a song called Wash Your Lobby. Let's have a listen.
The stair in our house has no floorboards. The lobby is just a big hole. Owl Riley has burdened the hall door. Too mean for to send out for coal. In Monto, you can't wash the lobby. It's always with lodgers too full. And if you walk too near the landing, you'll fall down and open your skull.
There you go. You get a sense of it there, that Dominic Behan. Dominic Behan actually singing there, MacDara, yeah?
It is indeed. That's an excerpt from a radio play or album that he made with Ewan McCall, just recounting the sort of street songs of Dublin and of Glasgow.
We got a sense, I was saying to you in studio here, Terry Fagan, you get a sense there when he's talking about, you know, you can fall down these stairs, bad things can happen in these places. It's not nostalgia.
Certainly not nostalgia. Like, I mean, in Monto in the heyday, there was 1,600 women operated in that area. And as I said, it was controlled by the famous madams of Monto. And they then had the men employed, the pimps, who would oversee their kind of business end of it. And the brothels in Monto were in first class, second class, third class and shilling houses.
Yeah, so it was stratified according to price, obviously, and I presume the treatment was worse the lower down the price.
Yep, it was. Like when these women lost their looks, they migrated down through the whole, into the shilling houses, and then from the shilling houses onto the streets. And then when they were on the streets, they were operating out of doorways and laneways there. And those pimps, it was two entrances to a laneway. There's a pimp up on one end and a pimp up the other. And they were there for two reasons. One was the fact to more or less protect the girl. If the client didn't pay for the sex, they could call out he hasn't paid and he couldn't go out of the lane because these guys are waiting on him. So they were kind of protecting them that. And also then they kept an eye on the madam's interest. So when the women went back, according to some of the locals that we interviewed, when the women went back to the houses in the morning time to the brothels, to the madams would say, well, how was business? And one girl might say, I was with six clients or seven clients, and the pimp would have his notes and say, no, she's very annoying, so strip her. Ooh. Until they find the money.
Yeah.
And then the madams would dish out punishment.
Yeah, and I'm sure, if that happened to it, wasn't just about finding the money, there was probably a beating coming out.
Oh, there was a beating, yeah. So we know from a Mr. King that I interviewed, he said, May Oblong, whose real name was May Roberts, and she was known as the Queen of Monto. And she got one of the pimps to hold the girl down. And according to this man, Mr. King, that she used a bacon knife on the girl's face to make sure no man would ever look at her again.
Yeah.
So it was vicious. Other madams didn't go to that extreme. They just tossed the women out naked onto the streets. That was a kind of a punishment there. It was horrific. There's nothing glorious about Monto.
Not at all the way you're describing it there. And in fact, you have a quote, I think, it's from Frank Hart originally, MacDara, about the difference between history and singing. Do you have it to hand there?
Yeah, I do. So Frank Hart, the great song collector and singer of Dublin songs and many songs, had the adage, those in power write the history and those who suffer write the songs. And essentially, if you look at the Irish song tradition, or indeed the folk traditions of any country, what you won't find is a very accurate representation of history. But honestly, if you look a bit closer, you might get an idea of how these things felt and what it was like to live through those times on an emotional level.
Yeah, because the idea that you're touching on here is that if you want to find out what happened, or at least a version of what happened, read a history book. But if you want to really get a sense of the feeling of it, sing a song or look for a song. How strong are the? Because you'll be performing the songs on the evening. How strong is the emotional content of a lot of the material you're singing?
Well, I guess it ranges in many ways. You may have some songs like The Monto or Wash Your Lobby, as you heard, but also songs like The Lock Hospital, which sort of tracks the journey of a woman who essentially ends up in the Lock Hospital, which is where people were sent with venereal diseases, and it's the end of her life, and she's regretting some of the choices that she's made. I mean, in many ways, it's written through a lens of a certain time in history, a bit judgmental of the woman in question. Mm. But, you know, it's certainly not celebrating or laughing about some of the horrors that occurred there, you know?
Let's listen to another song here, and again, very dark song. We were talking about this before we came down to studio tonight, hearing this song as a child, and you get very frightened even just by the first verse.
I know a woman, she lives in the wood, wheela, wheela, wheela. I know a woman, she is no good, down by the river side. She had a baby 3 months old, wheela, wheela, wheela. She had a baby with no clothes, down by the river side. She put the baby in a pond, wheela, wheela, wheela. She put it in with no clothes on, down by the river side.
Again, Wheeler, 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 Terry Fagan with me in studio, and McDarry Yates on the line. A very dark story. The soil, again, I thought this was a song from another part of the country because I have an aunt who lives in Kerry who always sang that song, and I thought it was a Kerry song. But the soil is a name for the river Poddle, is that?
Poddle, right? That's what we like to believe, yeah. Like there's so many songs written and kind of sung by street singers in that area, like, you know. And it's great that the fact that they're captured again and they're resurrecting again. Yeah. Like, you know, I know that's sad and there's the horrific and things that, but look, it's part of the folklore of the area. And I mean, just talking about those women, just the cap on them, those women, when they became pregnant in the brothels of Monto, they were no longer useful to the madam. She tossed them out. Mm. And when they were taken up into the rooms to have their baby, Mrs. Dunleavy was known as the midwife of Monto. She would deliver the baby. And once the baby was born, the woman would say to the person that took her in, would you mind me, child, will I go off and get somewhere to bring the baby? And they never come back for them. Right. And they were aired by the locals, and they're known in the area as the Monto babies.
Right, there you go. That's another side of a very dark part of our past as well. So what exactly then, if people go to attend online, it's a virtual tour that they'll be getting on the night, McDarrah, what exactly will be involved there?
Yeah, indeed. So just for clarity's sake, it's an afternoon tour. It'll be around 2 p.m. on Saturday, the 19th. But effectively, you're going to be taken on a virtual tour, a tour through streaming software. Myself will be there in a little window. Terry will be there in another little window. And we'll have a live feed of Google Maps. And we'll take you around the streets, dark lanes, alleyways, looking as they are in the modern day, and then deep, trying to delve into their past. And we'll stop at key locations for songs and stories and give what I hope is a very complete history of the history and the culture, I suppose, of the area.
And you'll be singing the songs. That's, you'll be performing the songs, and I suppose you then, Terry, you'll be giving
telling the stories
and the historical background. And it's all free.
All free, yeah. If you visit the McDarrah Yates Presents Facebook page, that's McDarrah, M-A-C-D-A-R-A, Yates, Y-E-A-T-E-S, Presents Facebook page. It'll go out live at 2 p.m. on Saturday the 19th.
Yeah, and people can find out details too. It's part of the Music Town Festival, and people can find out details on their website, which is musictown.ie. McDarrah and Tyree, thanks very much. I'm joined now from our Galway studio by Elaine Feeney, poet and now novelist, with the publication of her first novel, As You Were. We'll be chatting about the change from the poetic to the novelistic voice in a moment. But Elaine's going to start by reading the opening of the novel for us, As You Were, and I think that'll set the scene for us.
Pish rogues. I didn't tell a soul I was sick. Okay, I told a fat magpie. She was the first beating heart I met after the oncology unit, and she sat shiny and serious on the bonnet of the Volvo, one for sorrow. And I saluted her with that greeting you give when you find yourself alone and awkward with one magpie, and she flew away, piercing her black arc through the sky blue. After saluting Magpie, I sped at 139 kilometres per hour out along the M6. Stone walls hurled past, and end days of August conspired with the night, letting a cold dusk down. 39, fitting. On the car's windscreen, a fog was creeping around my eldest son's initials traced inside a fat heart. But I was fine. Father always told me I was fine, so as the years went by, I grew increasingly mistrustful of bad news bearers. Miss Sinead Hines was fine. Father said so. I was fine. I am fine. I will be fine.
And that's Elaine Feeney reading from the opening section of her novel, As You Were. And we find out who the narrator is there. I'm glad that you clarified that it was Miss Sinead Hines who was speeding down the M6 at 139 kilometres per hour. She's a young, a very driven property developer. But that terrible diagnosis that she gets, you know, from the very start of the opening pages of the book, it's pretty much the centre of the story. But this was inspired by an experience of your own in hospital, Elaine.
Hi, Sean. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good. It was actually. It was inspired by an experience of my own in 2014 when I got very ill and ended up in hospital being resuscitated and was told I had an hour to live and was very angry with myself because I'd let myself get into that state. And I think that's recurs through the novel. And I remember being at home after that trying to write some poems and they weren't really coming. And this book arrived, I suppose.
You were told you had an hour to live, or you were told kind of subsequently, if you hadn't come in, you were in deep trouble.
No, that was actually in the resuscitation of Galway University Hospital when a doctor was called in from ICU. He was a really big, tall guy with glasses. And I remember he was given out and, well, he was lovely, but he was obviously under pressure. And yeah. my mother was with me. And he asked my mother, how did I end up getting into a state like that? And I suppose my mother probably is exasperated with me at the best of times. So she was probably like, sure, how do we know anything about what Elaine does?
So in other words, that opening line of the book, I didn't tell us all I was sick. Had you kind of been yourself sitting on, well, there's something going on here, but I'm not quite sure what it is.
Sean, that's it exactly. You know, I had two pregnancies and I was diagnosed with pulmonary embolism on the first one and then a suspected brain clot on the second. Ooh. So I didn't want to be the sick person when I wasn't pregnant. I was like, it's fine. It's just a cold. It's just a flu. I'm just stressed with work and I'm busy. And I realise now the busy was probably just masking me looking at myself, I suppose. So that's where the idea for the beginning of the novel came from. But I parted company with Sinead Hines very quick after the first chapter, I think. I wouldn't keep the secret very long.
No, you'd either be to writing a poem about it, I suppose, yeah. Or writing a novel about it, as the case is here in some ways. Well, let's talk a little bit about the situations that Sinead Hines finds herself in. Because she is very secretive about all of this. She doesn't even tell her husband.
No, she's a very, very complicated character, Sinead. And I think the past never leaves her. And when she gets this diagnosis, you know, she heads off home. She flies out the M6 and, you know, she ends up going back into the house, into her husband, and she has three sons. They're all getting on with life. They're teenagers and growing up. And she never finds the right moment to tell Alex that she's sick. And one day rolls into another and rolls into another. And she ends up sort of detaching or disassociation, you know, with herself. And she goes down into the black hole of Google, which I probably have been guilty of myself in the past, spiralling down that, you know, we'll actually, So that's where that comes from anyway.
You could forgive Alex and those around her for being a little bit annoyed at her for not saying a word. But would you say that's her right? If she wants to say nothing, that's her prerogative.
You see, I really want to sit on the fence with this novel. I think I want to let the readers decide. Mm. A lot of people have come back to me very engaged about this and some people were very angry. My sister, Andrea, was one that said, I just wish she'd tell Alex. I think if we're to truly believe that people have autonomy over their bodies and that has been such a big subject in the last, you know, 10 years here in Ireland and long before it, but, you know, with the repeal referendum and so on, then I suppose we have to believe that you come into this world alone and you leave it alone. And I suppose it's a very, very difficult, it's a big moral dilemma, right? So I think that the novel hinges on that moral dilemma. Is she right? And I don't think that Sinead ever decides not to tell him. I just think it just happens. And I think sometimes life just happens like that.
And do you think the fact that I think you were writing this in and around the time of the amendment, for the repeal amendment, do you think that fed into it, perhaps not directly, but indirectly?
I actually think it fed directly into it. It was a really frantic space that time. And what I was noticing was having conversations with women at the time, they were really frantic and frenetic. And there was a lot of energy and there was a lot of sadness and anger. And what I noticed was that a lot of women were telling their stories, like on the radio and on the TV and in papers. And they were telling the most personal, deepest, traumatic stories around this referendum to try and, I suppose, maybe elicit empathy or understanding of what this meant and what the gravity of this referendum was. And I was writing the novel, you're right, in that space between equality and repeal, which is a very different space to now, I suppose. You know, I was much angrier and angstier, and the language, I think, of the novel definitely reflects that. You know, it's, somebody said it's a bit like bullets coming from a gun.
Well, it isn't all secrets being kept, although there are lots of secrets that come out to us. But there are women, three women in particular, well, Sinead being one of them, Margaret being another, and Jane being another. They find themselves in a ward together, the way you do in hospital, beside people you know little or nothing about until you're in the bed opposite them and you can know their life story within a few days.
Yeah, isn't that the bizarre thing? I suppose hospital is the great leveller in some ways, and I really wanted to put characters into a space where we could have these intergenerational conversations between women whose backs were against the wall. So you're right. So Margaret Rose Sherlock is this like ninja working class matriarch who's running her family from a rose gold Nokia phone. And then poor Jane Lohan is astray, is the best way to describe Jane. And yeah, Sinead doesn't want to be there at the start. You know, I've said she's a very unwilling patient. And I think most people are very unwilling patients, but it's a very intimate space, a hospital space. You know, it could be plonked in the middle of a city and you really wouldn't know where you are. And you do get to know, from spending time in hospital myself, you do get to know people very quickly, very deeply, and their most intimate traumas. It's a very unique and traumatic experience.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about that. I know you say you part company with Sinead in terms of after the very early in the first chapter, the parallels between your situation and hers and things that she does and doesn't do. But the other side of it is, I presume you did, or did you find yourself in a ward with other people where you found not only were they telling you their innermost secrets, but you were sharing yours with them?
You really don't have any choice. Sure you don't. You know, I've said it before, but the curtain isn't soundproof in a hospital setting. So it's like, you know, the doctors, with all due respect to them, come in to whisper, you know, diagnoses to people. And then, the patients would pop around the curtain. And I suppose that was the drama in the day when the doctors do their rounds in the morning and everyone heard everybody else's diagnoses. But the very sad thing about that is some of them were incredibly traumatic. And it's it's a weight to carry. So, and you're right, I do say I part company with Sinead. I have to. She's lots of affairs in the novel. I had to part company. She drinks espresso martinis. I'd never be caught dead at one.
An espresso martini. It's quite a powerful little drink for Sinead, isn't it?
Sinead likes the drink now, Sean.
The other side of this, of course, is, as I said at the beginning, I've spoken to you on several occasions about your poetry. You've performed your poetry for us. And I think, weren't you on with Lisa McInerney, speaking about this move towards the prose?
Yeah.
The prose situation.
Lucrative prose situation.
Yes, you did. You did point out that there wasn't enough money in poetry and there was lots more to be made, at least another 20 cent to be made in prose writing. But, you know, there was an auction for your novel, so let's not belittle that. What was it, do you think, that made you know that this was a story that could only be told in prose, as opposed to, you know, writing a series of poems, which it could have been a series of, you know, very singular poems, personal poems?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I really did tire off the eye and myself very much. And I really wanted to sort of represent the colour and magic of characters. And I really wanted to push it into a fictional space, because I suppose I was getting a bit tired of answering the questions around the poetry of did this happen and did this happen and so on, you know.
Did that happen to you? Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I mean, poetry is always going to be my first love, and I'm very thankful for my slam background, and I think it has fed into the novel in some ways. Yeah. You know, I know many people say it's a poetry and prose hybrid. I didn't really mean that on purpose. It's probably just my style of writing, you know. And again, as I said about the lucrative nonsense of the biz, I have a Range Rover now, Sean. I'm only joking.
Yeah,
no joke.
I think we can get that one all right. One of the other things, I mean, obviously you're talking about this communication between the people in a public ward, because there's more than two or three people in the ward, but there's also a meditation here in several different ways around parenthood and this idea of absent parents. Even parents who are present in the room can actually be absent even while they're sitting in front of their children.
Yeah, I mean, as a parent myself, I suppose this was a really big topic for me, was to maybe write a woman that I felt reflected, you know, maybe a female character in Sinead that hadn't been reflected before. And she is absent from her boys while she's in hospital. She has to be. And also she has the very, I suppose, she has the role in the family of being the provider, and, you know, she's a go-getter. And I really wanted to write a woman like that. I think that's an important thing to see and be seen. You know, Alex is a great man. He's a great father and so on. So her absence doesn't actually do the kids any major damage. You know, they're all getting on with their own lives. I think it's just when she comes face to face with her own mortality that she realises maybe, oh, this is what I've done. Now, she's not heavily critical of herself. It just is a thing. That's the way it is, you know?
Yeah, but I wondered, was that part of what you were looking at here, you know, that in fact, maybe sometimes a little bit of absence for a parent, or another, as they might say, a little bit of me time, you know, is actually necessary, and that there shouldn't be a load of guilt around that.
Well, guilt is a wasted emotion, really, I think. And I think we need to let ourselves off the hook a little bit more. If you were to have me time, though, I'd rather it not to be on a high dependency unit of a crumbling hospital.
Yes.
But yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, she's a complicated mother figure, and she loves her boys. But I do know that, you know, it's going to be difficult for some readers, I suppose, to maybe figure her out. And you're right, yeah, a little bit of me time doesn't, and guilt is a wasted emotion. And I think the boys are going to be fine, which is often the sad thing for us mothers sometimes. You know, my older boy Jack is doing the leave insert now, and, you know, he's sort of beginning to start to, you know, move out a little bit out of my space. And yeah I'm kind of going around going, what'll I do now, you know? But yeah.
And he'll love you for telling the nation about that this evening. One final question. Yeah. So, Elaine, are you going to stick with the very lucrative prose, or are you going to dip your foot back into the poverty-stricken poet? I presume you'll be doing both.
I think I'll keep a foot, in both. Yeah, I've been going back to a few poems. I'm editing the Galway edition of The Stinging Fly, and I'm actually editing poetry at the moment.
Right.
And it's magic, so that might get the poetic juices flowing again.
But
I'm working on a second novel.
Okay. Well, and second novel on the way. Well, I look forward to it when it comes, and congratulations on the first. As You Were is the title of Elaine Feeney's debut novel, and it is published by Harville Secker. A new and altogether different screen excitement. I should have my voiceover voice on for that one. That's what was said. It said on the posters. And indeed, that's how Alfred Hitchcock went about marketing the most controversial film of his career. Indeed, it's 60 years since Hitchcock's Psycho was released in cinemas, often considered one of the greatest films ever made. This game-changing display pulled the rug from under audiences with its audacious first act twist, and it paved the way for a new breed of cinematic horror. But it wasn't an easy task. Hitchcock risked his personal fortune on a film that nobody wanted to make, and it could just have easily ended his career. Well, to take a look behind at the story behind the masterpiece, Chris Wasser joins me now on the line. If you went to the cinema, Chris, in 1960, if you were able to go and see a screening of Psycho, there was a strange-looking billboard in the foyer of, I presume, all cinemas where it was screening at the time.
That's right, Sean. Yes, if you were lucky enough to have attended the screening of Psycho in its first week of release in American cinemas, if you walked into the foyer to get your tickets, you mentioned, you know, the first great tagline there. There was another one. You would see a life-size cutout, a cardboard cutout of Alfred Hitchcock standing next to another poster that said, "It is required that you see Psycho from the very beginning." And of course, Hitchcock was in his usual, you know, he was resplendent in his usual formal get-up, you know, the black suit and the shirt and the tie, but he was pointing at his watch. And there was some other text underneath about, you know, how the theatre managers and owners have been threatened with their lives, that if they admit latecomers, you know, they'll lose their lives, they'll lose their businesses. Mm. And it was all very funny and it was all quite dark. But, you know, and I'd also argue you're probably required to see every film from the very beginning. Yeah. But what Hitchcock was doing there was that he had single-handedly orchestrated this ingenious lo-fi publicity campaign where he focused on the first act of Psycho. Shocking, was, you know, the first act of Psycho was so shocking because, you know, 60 years on, I think we can spoil it, Sean, you know, Marion Crane does not make it out alive in the first hour.
And this is Janet Leigh's character, yeah.
Yes, this is Janet Leigh's character. And he didn't want anyone spoiling that. And he believed that you should see it from the very beginning because those first 40 minutes are all about Marion Crane. So he, you know, put together this ingenious campaign. And he also, you know, aside from that cardboard cutout that you would have seen in cinemas, you also saw on televisions these weird commercials that didn't actually feature any scenes from the film whatsoever. And he even kept his stars away from media because what he wanted basically was people talking about this movie without knowing anything about it.
Actually, that's the whole idea, isn't it? People are always saying, don't tell us what the film is about, but it's very hard to talk about a film if you don't talk what the film is about. Let's listen to the moment when Janet Leigh comes and checks in to the Bates Motel and is greeted by Norman, played by Anthony Perkins, of course.
Dirty night.
Do you have a vacancy?
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. They moved away the highway.
Oh, I thought I'd gotten off the main road.
I knew you must have. Nobody ever stops here anymore unless they've done that. But there's no sense dwelling on our losses. We just keep on lighting the lights and following the formalities. Your home address? Oh, just the town will do.
Los Angeles.
Cabin one. It's closer in case you want anything. Right next to the office.
I want sleep more than anything else, except maybe food.
Well, there's a big diner about 10 miles up the road, just outside of Fairvale.
Am I that close to Fairvale?
15 miles. I get your bags.
And there we go. 60 years on, you're saying, get out now, don't go near the place. Obviously, that's a clip from Psycho, and Chris Wasser helping us to celebrate the 60th anniversary of Psycho. That scene, I'm kind of wondering, Chris, it is very hard to listen to anything from the film now without all of the knowledge we have of it. Was that how it worked at the time, given that it was an adaptation of a crime novel? Was the crime novel particularly well known, or was it just Hitchcock playing around?
No, see, this is the genius of it again, Sean, in that, you know, Psycho barely, you know, had a minute to sell itself on bookshelves before Alfred Hitchcock was adapting it. So not a lot of people had read it at this stage. They heard about this shocking novel, you know, this scandalous novel about a serial killer who, you know, dresses up as his mother and, you know, kills anybody who crosses the door of their motel, the Bates Motel. And it didn't help matters that it was actually inspired. Robert Bloch, the author of Psycho, was inspired to write the novel based on a real case, that of Ed Gein. He was a notorious serial killer in the 1950s who actually kept his victims' heads in jars. So it was all quite, you know, despicable and horrific. And the novel was just published in 1959 when Alfred Hitchcock's secretary, Peggy Robertson, and also his script supervisor, she brought it to his attention. I mean, at that time, you know, he was kind of wondering, what will I do next? A lot of his critics were saying, maybe you should retire, despite the fact that he was only 59, Sean.
Yeah.
And he still had an awful lot left to give, and he still wanted to work on big projects. But Paramount wanted him to work on this big, you know, showy legal drama with Audrey Hepburn. But he saw this novel, handed to him by Peggy Robertson. He read it, and he thought, you know what? I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it the way that I want to, regardless of whether Paramount give me the money. And they wouldn't. They thought it was going to be scandalous. No one would want to see it. And I'm going to do it before anyone gets a chance to know what happens in this story.
Yeah. And it was it because he couldn't get the studio that he pumped his own money into it? How successful was he at that point? Did he have a lot of? Did he have very deep pockets?
He had very deep pockets, but he did have to take out a second mortgage on his house, Sean, and he was able to put $800,000 into the production of this money. Now, Paramount had actually signed a deal with him where they said, well, we'll distribute this film, but we certainly won't be financing it. And I'd say I put money on that, on them having made that decision, because they actually didn't think he'd go ahead, or that he'd get, you know, the crew, the cast, whatever. But of course he did. And I mean, he was very efficient with his money. He'd spent somewhere in the region of $4.5 million on North by Northwest, on Vertigo, films that he had just worked on 2 or 3 years beforehand. So that's just to remind you that at this stage of his career, Paramount is saying no to the guy who made North by Northwest and Vertigo. That is just incredible in the last 12 months. But he took his $800,000 and he said to the crew of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents television show, can you come work for me? Because they were cheaper and because everyone got on well together. And he also decided to shoot it in black and white when Technicolor was at his disposal, but black and white. I mean, Hitchcock went around saying that he wanted to add, you know, more to the horror side of the story by having it, you know, visually and literally darker, but black and white was actually cheaper than Technicolor. And he also managed to convince Janet Leigh, based on his reputation, based on the fact that, you know, she had liked all of his work, to star for a reduced fee. So he went a long way with that $800,000.
And how much did he spend on the shower curtain, Dino?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what the figure was, but they spent one-tenth. I think they shot it over Christmas of 1959 into the spring of 1960, and it was a 10 to 11 week shoot. 1 week of that shoot was spent filming the shower sequence. And he just went at it again and again and again. I mean, there's all sorts of great stories here about how, you know, the final scene incorporates some 70 shots, some 56 angles. You know, when you're hearing the knife going into the body, sorry to be so grisly, but you're actually listening to a knife going into a watermelon. He wanted to get this perfect. And he also decided, here's one, you know, for you know, trivia fans, he also decided to use chocolate sauce because that shows up better in black and white. than fake blood. But this was going to be the centrepiece of the film, Sean, and he had to get it right.
And here he is, subsequent to the film, I presume, visiting the bathroom of the famous shower scene. It's a rather unusual ad, but here is Alfred Hitchcock pitching Psycho at the audience.
Well, they cleaned all this up now. Big difference. You should have seen the blood. The whole place was, well, it's too horrible to describe. Dreadful. And I'll tell you, there's a very important clue was found here. Down there. Well, the murderer, you see, crept in here. Very slowly, of course, the shower was on, there was no sound. And,
isn't it such a great sound when you hear it? the unforgettable Bernard Herrmann score, of course, in the probably the most infamous scene from Psycho, the scene in the shower where poor old Marion meets her end, obviously. Hitchcock didn't want the music.
He didn't want the music, Sean. He thought it would actually be more frightening for audiences if they could just hear the sound of Marion being murdered, basically. And also trying to focus their attention on who it was that was murdering her, because at the time audiences think, well, it must be, you know, Norman's mad mother up on the hill. She's come down to kill Marion. What has she done? But Bernard Herrmann said, that's all well and good, but can you just listen to this piece that I thought you wanted music for this? Can you just listen to it? Alfred Hitchcock heard it and thought, I have to put this in. And also that commercial, the clip that you just played, that's from the commercials that I was talking about, where he was basically just advertising the film as though it was a real life horror. And he didn't even use the actress. He didn't even use Janet Leigh for that commercial. He actually asked Janet Leigh's sister to star in it. So he kept everyone away until they saw the final film.
Right. What about, you know, the story around the mother? How much psychology is at play here in terms of the mother obsession that we get from Norman?
Oh, I mean, this film was actually made to be dissected and explored and pulled apart. And the whole idea that, you know, Norman Bates is, you know, the, there are those iconic scenes near the beginning where Norman Bates, played brilliantly by Anthony Perkins, who I think was like pushing harder than any other actor at the time, one of the first character actors. You know, the idea that he's talking about how his mother is his best friend and that, you know, they might have a more sinister relationship than you might imagine. Of course, the psychiatrist at the end explains everything. It's quite dark, and this is one of the reasons that Paramount balked, because, you know, say Hitchcock had made disturbing films about disturbed characters before, but he had always suggested more than he had shown. And with Psycho, you know, Paramount were worried that you can't, it's 1959, you can't present audiences with a film where, you know, the psycho sexual deviant or the serial killer is the center of the film. But here we have someone who is trying to get, you know, the woman who they will murder on side with them. He's trying to get the audience on side with them, because Psycho also does something, you know, quite unique, you know, 40 minutes in, which, as I've said, it switches perspective and we follow him then for the rest. And what I love as well, the big thing for me going in, or watching Psycho, you know, for the umpteenth time ahead of this item, was seeing that, you know, everyone in this film actually is someone who, you know, is lying to themselves. There's almost a psychotic nature, there's a sociopathic nature to every character in this film, whether it's Marion Crane at one point enjoying herself while she's robbing the money from her employers. It's Arbogast, the personal, you know, the private investigator who takes pleasure in blaming people on crimes they didn't commit. Everyone in this film is keeping secrets from themselves and from others. So there's an awful lot, you know, this film digs a lot deeper than any other horror that was around at the time.
And that's what has made it last. You clearly really enjoyed watching it again. It stood the test of time, Chris.
Oh, absolutely. For me, it's still the perfect horror. And also that scene in the shower, I mean, you know, it's been played to death, it's been copied, but it's never been equaled. And it still just frightens me. Something awful.
Chris Wasser speaking to us about Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, which is 60 years old this year.
You're listening to Arena.
A new visual art project, the Women on Women Awards, aims to highlight the work carried out by Irish women in the field of radical activism and social justice. The project is the work of Outlandish Theatre, which has collaborated with the filmmaker Jetta Debris to produce intimate film portraits of these women. And the final piece will be streamed across several platforms, including RTE.ie, on Culture Night. And that's this very Friday, the 18th of September. Joining me now on the line, Mavis Ramazani, and of the Irish Refugee Council, who is the subject of one of those films, and Bernie O'Reilly of Outlandish Theatre Company. Bernie, to tell us first of all what this how the project came about and what Outlandish Theatre Company, your company, wanted to achieve with it.
Sure. So myself and artist Maud Hendricks are artists in residence at the Coombe Women and Infants University Hospital. We've been making work for the last 10 years with community participants, professional performers and creative teams in traditional arts environments and in community contexts. And last year, we were invited to become a partner in a Creative Europe project, which is called Women on Women, which is a two-year project with three partner organisations where we are exploring the representation of women in the arts and the public domain. So for us, this has been a really fabulous opportunity. There's like many different strands within the Women on Women project. There's performance work, there is also, we have a conference coming up, and then this strand, the WOW Awards, was a moment for us to highlight women who are working in Ireland and who are fighters for social justice and gender equality. So it was an awards call-out which we launched, which as a theatre company we were slightly uncomfortable with. You know, how do we as artists say, you know, we're going to award, and this is quite a patriarchal way of acknowledging people's work. However, with the WOW Awards, what we've realised is through this call-out, which really went through the grassroots networks within Ireland, was that there's incredible work going on, and there's women who are really creating change and supporting other humans. And as artists, that's what we look to do. We look to consider the world we live in and then to consider the world we would like to live in. So it actually became a really perfect match for a collaboration with all of the five women who were the award winners. and with that is Deirdre De Bruyt.
Well, as I said, we have one of the women in question on the line with us as well this evening, Mavis Ramanzani. But let's listen to Mavis, part of Mavis's contribution to the film work that we had a look at earlier on today. So this is Mavis.
Asylum seekers and refugees with diverse migrant experiences need autonomy over their own lives to overcome their traumas, integrate with communities, and live in dignity. The need for dignity does not diminish the other. People needing safety is no reason to restrict access to protection. We must care about refugees at our doorstep and Europe's doorstep.
And that's Mavis Ramanzani as she performs, or as she tells us, her part of her story in the Women on Women's Portrait film that we're speaking about this evening. Mavis, how did you become involved in the project? Who approached you about this?
I became involved in the project because of the work that I do with refugees and asylum seekers in Ireland, you know, as a lone parent, as a mom, as an activist, and Outlandish TS members knew the kind of community work and activism work that I'm doing with Irish Refugee Council, the movement of asylum seekers in Ireland, Refugee and Migrant Solidarity Ireland, and also as the founder of Cooking for Freedom, which is a project that myself as a refugee, as asylum seekers, I bring together other refugees and asylum seekers, and we cook together because, like I said, you know, we need to welcome refugees at our own doorstep and in Europe doorstep. So that's how the Outlandish Theatre platform knew about the work that I do.
And I'm wondering, I mean, at this stage, we hear so much, we've heard so often about the difficulties and the problems that direct provision presents and presents particularly to asylum seekers. Can you believe that some other form of housing asylum seekers has not been arrived at this point in time?
It's such a shock because people living in direct provision in these institutions have traumas. I'm one of them. I have multiple traumas, actually. So the fact that this system has not changed, it is just horrible because it just traumatizes you even further when you already have a trauma that you came with. So the institution, being institutionalized, is not helping. As you know, a few weeks ago, Arif from Afghanistan committed suicide. So it's a daily struggle for individuals like myself to be living in this system. It should be dismantled. It must be dismantled, basically.
And coming back to you then, Bernie, I was taken by the aesthetic of the way we meet the five women involved. There's quite a long, each woman stands absolutely still, a head and shoulder shot, looking directly at the camera. And there's quite a long period of time before anybody speaks. Why was that important to you in terms of, I felt I kind of got to know the person before she opened her mouth.
Well, that's wonderful, because that is what we were really hoping to achieve, is that all of the wonderful WOW Award winners, they all work so hard and, you know, put so much energy and expertise into their activism that sometimes you don't see the person behind the activism. So for us, it was really important to actually really look into the eyes of this person and get a moment to just breathe with them. And I think, you know, the medium of film really allows you to do that.
And how important is it, or how, for you, was it that this is part of Culture Night? It is quite a platform for the film to get, I would think.
We are absolutely delighted. Culture Night is something that like can go to every living room this year with the new format for it. So the fact that it has a national platform and it's, you know, introducing people's work and people's vision and people's hopes. You know, culture is all about starting a conversation, and sometimes that can be slightly confrontational. It can make us think. It can really make us look at the society that we live in, and I think these portraits really do that. And I think they're really easily accessible for everybody, and they're really, really exciting to watch. So I think Culture Night was a perfect platform, and we were delighted to be invited by IMA and by the Arts Council to present them.
All right, that's Bernie O'Reilly of Outlandish Theatre on the Women on Women project, and Mavis Ramazani, who is one of those featured in the portrait film. You can see Women on Women's portrait film. It'll be screened online 7:35 p.m. on Friday evening as part of IMA's online Culture Night programme. It'll be followed by a panel discussion with the WOW awardees, Women on Women, that's W-O-W, in the People's Pavilion at IMA on Saturday the 19th. And you can also see it as part of RTE's Culture Night programme, and that's on rte.ie/culture. It'll be screened at Meeting House Square in Temple Bar on Culture Night. And the event's in Meeting House Square from 8 p.m. through until 10:30 p.m. Booking will be announced via social media channels and on the Culture Night website on Wednesday evening. But that's our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy was the researcher this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound supervision this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night. Oh yes, I should also say thank you to John Doyle in Galway for that link up earlier on as well. But that is our lot for this evening.